Lori Musier is here to talk with Michael Harriet just about these movements and the issues we're facing around police violence. Lori?
Thanks, Denise. Michael Harriet is a writer, podcaster, spoken word poet, and host of the Black One podcast, which has grown to become one of the most listened to podcasts in Black America. In 2008, he released his first novel, The Situation in South Carolina, to critical success. And last January, he launched his latest venture, Negus Who Read, a hub for information, opinion, and ideas for Black thinkers. Welcome to KBOO, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
You are an amazingly incisive and prolific writer. Your commentary seemed to be everywhere. And although some of your pieces have generated controversy, it seems to me that you are stating the obvious about the hypocrisy of the American state and media and how most white Americans just don't get it about the day-to-day indignities, repression, and violence that Black people experience. Let's start with a basic fact that you discussed recently in Ebony. Do Black people enjoy the same constitutional rights as other Americans?
Well, I think the piece that you're speaking of, I went through all of the amendments in the first 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights. And what I spoke about was listing them one by one and, you know, giving examples where Black people don't enjoy the same freedoms or the same access to those Bill of Rights that regular Americans do. And, you know, it's evident. I'd like to approach things from, I teach a course called Race as an Economic Construct. So I don't approach things through popular sentiment. I approach them through numbers, facts, and research. And so most of what I say, I try to back up with evidence, with statistical evidence, with research. And so, it's evident that we don't enjoy a lot of those rights that most Americans enjoy.
And that seems very obvious, and a lot of your writing is just the underscoring of those kinds of facts and contrasting the rights that some Americans might receive versus Black Americans. And in particular, the Second Amendment, as you have written, it's almost reified as a part of our culture. But the NRA has never rushed into the defense of Black people murdered by police under the pretense of carrying a weapon in an open carry state. So, but yet there's this widespread image and understanding that guns protect Blacks, given that the state does not. And you've noted that Malcolm X and the Black Panthers frequently noted that the Second Amendment was the only right that Blacks had. And there's an influential book by Charles Cobb about how guns kept people alive in the civil rights movement. But you argue that it is laws that govern firearms that offer protection.
Right. So we have to note, first of all, that the Second Amendment historically was never used as as an individual right. It was always thought of as a collective right of the people to protect themselves against a tyrannical government until right after the Civil War, when African Americans enjoying their full citizenship started buying guns, and there arose an opposite force to stop them from owning guns. And that force eventually grew to be called the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was originally an organization whose main goal was to stop African-Americans from arming themselves. And the Second Amendment was first argued as an individual right by Black people because we had to protect ourselves from what we call now the state, because the state, these lynch mobs, when you look at the history of lynching in the South and in the Midwest, that was the government to Black people. And the only protection we enjoyed was the individual right to arm ourselves. So it's a right that we've always held dear, and it's important to look at that aspect in the historical context of Black protection against the state.
Even though often people, even Martin Luther King Jr., when applying for a concealed weapon permit, was denied that right.
Right. Martin Luther King was denied that right. The rise of the Black Panthers in Oakland was initially about denying African Americans the right to own guns. You know, the first major restriction of gun rights in America was in California when they wanted to restrict the gun rights because of the threat, that they called it, of the Black Panthers and the Black Panther Party going up, following police when they arrested or detained Black people.
Right, right. And you point out that the average American is 58 times more likely to be killed by a cop than a terrorist, and that Americans are more likely to be killed by police or other gun violence.
So, you know, there's an article that just came out today that I wrote for The Root, and it lists most Americans' fears: killed by terrorists, killed by armed robbers. And what I point out is that all of those things are less likely than a Black person being killed by police. You know, ProPublica did an article, a statistical research about 2 years ago that showed that the average Black male is 21 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than a white person. And all of the statistical research bears it out, that the most of the things that we fear are far less likely to happen than a Black person just walking down the street being killed by police.
Yeah. And you also use those statistics to marshal evidence to point out how gun control really does help protect Black communities. Do you want to say more about
that?
Right.
Because when we talk about, for instance, the buzzword now in all of politics and all of the discussion about Black Lives Matter and Black violence, they always go to Chicago, and they point out the number of murders in Chicago. And when you look at the research, while there are a lot of murders in Chicago, Chicago isn't listed in the top 10 most dangerous cities for gun violence. And that's because, simply, there are a lot of people in Chicago. Chicago has a higher murder rate than New York or Los Angeles, which are the only two cities that are bigger than Chicago. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is Chicago's rate of violence higher than those two big cities? Well, California and New York have very strict gun laws. And so Illinois doesn't have those gun laws, and that accounts for the predominance in violence in that state versus other big cities.
And you note the context for the passage of the Gun Control Act in 1968, which on the heels of uprisings in cities across the country in the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. And ironically, the death rate from gun violence dropped pretty significantly in Black communities. But that was a figure that the Clinton administration and others tended to ignore when repealing some of those gun controls much later. Is that correct?
Yes. There are a few misconceptions about gun laws, because every time we see a mass shooting, there are a few things that we want to put on the books concerning gun laws. And those things statistically never work. For instance, if we stop people from owning semi-automatic weapons, it surprised me when I researched it that there aren't really a lot of mass killings done with semi-automatic weapons. It's it's popular sentiment that makes us think these things shouldn't be on the street. But even if we restricted semi-automatic weapons, for instance, it wouldn't really signal a result in a big drop in gun violence, because most gun violence is done with a concealed weapon, a pistol. So if we want to stop more gun violence, and if we want to work from big to small, what we'd have to do is restrict the ownership of concealed weapons, small handguns. And that's what causes most gun violence.
Well, you also talk about how at the root of violence against Black people, irregardless of gun violence within Black communities, that at the root of police violence, or even the fact that Americans ignore the need for gun control, is the white fright, the fact that white Americans have this fear, and this is, of course, a deeply ingrained fear from centuries of propaganda that police tend to perpetuate in their communities, in urban police forces. Do you want to say more about this phenomenon of white fright and how the kind of violence that has emanated towards Black people have come from this deep-rooted fear?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of two things. I think it's one of it is just our natural reaction to seeing, because when you watch TV and, for instance, if you saw four murders and two were committed by Blacks and two were committed by whites, the white guys who committed the murder are just guys who committed the murder. The Black guys are Black guys who committed murder. So naturally, we tend to associate violence when we see Black people committed with, he did that because he's a Black guy, right? So it's a little bit of propaganda, but it's a little bit of what I call white fright, the irrational fear of Black people or things that will happen to a white person because Black people will do it. And when we talk about that, we have to realize, and this is the biggest statistic that no one ever talks about. Every statistical analysis, the Bureau of Justice Statistics comes out every year and shows that violence and crime is basically a socioeconomic phenomenon. The more poor Black people who are poor and white people who are poor commit crimes at the same rate. Black people who are middle class, white people who are middle class commit crimes at about the same rate. And it goes up for every economic class. So crime has never been a racial phenomenon. It's a socioeconomic phenomenon, which is why America never asks itself, well, if that is true, why are there so many poor Black people? That is the root of the question that we should be asking ourselves. We, during this presidential debate, I noticed when they started talking about race in the last debate, they immediately went to crime. Like, when they talked, they said, let's talk about Black people. And both candidates immediately started talking about crime. And there is one thing that they never brought up. Why in a country as rich and as powerful and as progressive as America is, that promises freedom for everybody, why do we even just as a matter of factly talk about Black neighborhoods? Why is there still a thing called Black neighborhoods in a country that is supposed to be free? We never talk about the history of redlining and segregation as it relates to crime.
Right, right. There's not anything about the structural racism that creates that kind of the economic disparities and targeting of Black communities, all having to do with the kinds of disparities that you're emphasizing. Michael Harriet, just in the few minutes that we have remaining, want to talk about your media activism, because we've been talking about protests in the streets and the rise of Black Lives Matter, which is such a hopeful movement. But you've been carrying on these subversive protests online. Can you talk a bit about some of your work with your podcast and other media journalism that's having such an impact?
Well, I began doing all of this, the podcast, a lot of the writing, in response to a lack of balance in voices. Lately, there's been a conversation amongst journalists about why there are so few journalists in the forefront of the media. You know, when you talk about the 24-hour cable news networks, there are very few Black anchors, for instance. And so I don't think there's a balance of voices, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the propaganda or misconceptions about Black neighborhoods, Black people in general, how we are supposedly predisposed to violence. And we don't have the equality of representation in the media. And I think that's important, right? So if America is going to have a conversation about race, and it is always white people who are engaging us in the conversation, then it really isn't an equal conversation, because both sides aren't represented.
Well,
so that is Great.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I'm sorry, Michael Harriet, we've run out of time, but thanks so much for speaking with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we'll post a link to your website, michaelharriet.com. And listeners can find Michael Harriet's writing in a variety of online publications, including Very Smart Brothers, The Root, Deadspin, and Ebony.
Thank you for having me.